Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Tom, this is one of the darkest days in modern Top Chef history. I am crushed, crushed over the dismissal of Nene Wynn.
Kevin, cheer up. Don't you still have Brian Malarkey on your team?
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
I'm Tom Haverstroh.
Tom, last week we identified a top tier with three chefs, Melissa, Gregory, Kevin, and this week only solidified further that that tier, in fact, exists. It is dominant. Gregory wins the quickfire, and the powerhouse team of Melissa and Kevin walk away with the elimination challenge.
Yes, Melissa is, I mean, is she 73-9 Golden State Warriors at right now? I'm talking about three wins for her in six episodes. She is on fire, Kevin. She is not just winning three episodes out of the first six challenges, but she is doing it in an all-star season with no bottom three finishes, Kevin. She hasn't fumbled at all this entire competition. Three wins, six episodes, no bottoms. You know how many times that's happened in Top Chef history, Kevin?
I would suspect very rarely. Do you have the stats?
I do have the stats. Season 12, Gregory comes close. Four wins, one low. Not quite what Nene's done. Three wins, no lows. Season 6, Brian Voltaggio, three wins, no bottom. In his first six episodes in season 6, Brian Voltaggio is in this competition. Gregory Gourdette is in this competition. And yet...
Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass-on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like, yeah, whatever.
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep. Free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise, but maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
Melissa is the king. Melissa King is doing it with those two in the competition. I posit to you, Kevin, that this is the greatest six-episode start in Top Chef's history.
Yeah, it's not just the way she's cooking, too, because, I mean, just look at this episode, right? What does she do for the starter, for the quick fire? She does a financier. I mean, everybody's doing entrees. She's just, you know what? I'm gonna do this lovely little almond cake, and it is going to place. Then gets to the elimination challenge with Kevin. We don't need protein. Who needs a stinking protein? We'll go with the cabbage. So it's not just that she's dominating. It is the ballsiness and just the sheer confidence of her choices that she cares not for the conventions of the show. She is going to cook her food. One of the great tropes of Top Chef, cook your food. She is cooking her food, Tom.
She is. And I mean, I feel bad that Nene's out of the competition here. I feel bad for your team. I feel bad for just in general. I love how delightful she is in the show. But I think the great development of this season is Melissa. And yes, she didn't finish as like the runner-up in her season, but she was still pretty strong, just like the Golden State Warriors were a few years ago when they ran off with a 24-0 start. I think this is one of those – This is Melissa right now. This is king shit. This is Melissa King. I mean, we all need to bow down to Melissa. I know that Gregory is winning like quick fire after quick fire here, but Melissa, she has not stumbled once on this show. And Gregory, I know he's doing really, really well. I'm happy that he's on my team, but I just got to say, Melissa is on another level.
There is enough love to go around. Another big development for me this week is – Tom, I have to confess, especially after the last few episodes, I'm finally starting to get malarkey. Like, I think it's clear that everyone Hold on. I want you to let me kind of riff on this theory. I think it's clear everyone is in on the joke. I think it's clear that it's performance. I think it's clear that he is a willing heel. I think it is clear that Padma cannot keep a straight face because she finds him so amusing. And I'm starting to finally get it. Like, I think there is a little bit of, you know, it's funny. Didn't we make a Skip Bayless parallel a couple weeks ago. Well, he's sort of the willing heel. Like, it is an act. And I think this week I started seeing it through a new lens, which is, yeah, it's shtick. And it's,
no.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I'm getting it. That's all
You're
I'm
getting
saying.
The fact that he screwed up his quickfire so bad he could only put like a scoop of ice cream into a dish.
Oh, I'm not saying I'm naming him top chef. I'm not saying I want to invest a penny in whatever dalliance he makes in restaurant world, okay? What I'm saying is, as a character, I'm starting to get the malarkey thing. And it was actually through Padma that I'm getting it. It is so clear that she is amused. And Padma is amused by nothing. This is not a woman who is easily amused. I think 17 seasons of Top Chef has borne that out. So I'm starting to get the malarkey thing. Actually, I think we will talk more about this later, even though I've never been so sure of an outcome as I was about the elimination of Malarkey and Leanne. Lo and behold, they not only acquit themselves, they almost damn win the damn competition.
Shout out to the magical elves, the production, the editing team on this one. I mean, I thought it was a slam dunk that they were going to be eliminated right from the get-go. And they showed us that throughout the episode. They were leaning into it. And then, boom, a 180. It was quite the finish, quite the turnaround. So, Kevin, let's get right through it. Let's go. Let's get to the jump.
Right, so we've got the quickfire. The guest judge of quickfire is a chef I love, Chris Bianco from Pizzeria Bianco in Phoenix. Tom, one of my absolute favorite places. This is true story. December 2017, I'm running a half marathon in Scottsdale. Starts about 7, 8 a.m. I don't even remember. And I had decided that Pizza Bianco back in downtown Phoenix, where I was staying, three blocks away, opens at noon. I'm going to run this race. I'm going to go back to the Hotel Palomar in downtown Phoenix. I am going to shower. I'm going to pack. And I'm going to be on the doorstep of Pizzeria Bianco at 11:57 a.m. with 13.1 miles under my belt. And I'm going to eat not one, but two Pizzeria Biancos. And I damn well did, man. I had my favorite, the Sunny Boy with olives and salami. And then I also had the Rosa, which is the rosemary and pistachio pizza with roasted onion. And I was going to eat one and take one for the road. Let's just say that second one did not make it to the road. It's a wonderful place. You know, our friend Amin Alhassan is a huge devotee of Pizzeria Bianco.
Yeah, Amin is a huge fan. I texted him a photo of Chris next to Padma and said, "Hey, look who's on this week's Top Chef." And he goes, "My guy, Chris." Amin adores this guy. Anytime you're in Phoenix and you want some good food, Amin demands that you go get in touch with Chris and he'll find you a seat at Pizzeria Bianco. Now, I was surprised to see him on this episode because does he have LA connections, Kevin? Or is this just simply, hey, we wanted to do feature his restaurant and his, the flour with the pizza. We want to do that. I didn't know if he had a restaurant in LA or not, or maybe he was born in LA.
Yeah, no. He actually, at the Row in downtown Los Angeles, this new-ish complex, they brought Pizzeria Bianco to downtown Los Angeles. So,
perfect.
And that was just in the past few months, really. So I have not even been yet. But it's he is dipping his toe into the culinary waters of Los Angeles, which is, I think, why he's in. Also, it makes sense because they're having a flour challenge, except no glutinous, good old fashioned wheat flour in this contest. The chefs have to go pick one of these other flours and make a dish. And that is the challenge.
I'm not experienced in this area, Kevin. Are you?
So one of the things is, as a gay man in Los Angeles, I am a hardened carbophobe. I have talked about this condition on the show before. I just look at a carbohydrate and that's it. Done. So I avoid carbohydrates. Also, I avoid baking because the thing is, Tom, if I started baking, that would just be trouble. Because what would happen is I would make lemon squares and eat them all in one night. Like if I ever learned how to bake, I would be so fucked. I would immediately, it would just be a disaster. So I've always avoided flour, not just because of the carbophobia, but because just knowing just the trouble it will lead to.
Yeah. My wife, she's been trying to find activities for the kid, the 3-year-old Madeline during this lockdown. And inevitably, like twice, three times a week, she ends up doing, baking or cooking, and it ends up me just crushing a bunch of brownies or crushing a bunch of coffee cake or whatever it is. And it's deadly. It is so hard to avoid just, you know, when like you have that dish that almost like for Easter, we had a huge dish in the kitchen full of Starburst jelly beans. Do you know how much restraint you have to not just fistful, just shove jelly beans every time you walk into the kitchen? It's impossible. And I kind of feel like it's the same thing with baking bread at home. Like if I could do that, if I had that skill, and I know it's really big in this pandemic right now is baking your own bread.
What is it with the bread baking? It's everywhere.
I have no idea. What timing about this episode, considering that everyone is doing their own sourdough? I haven't done it. I don't know. None of my friends have done it here in Charlotte, but I got to imagine that if you do start going down that path, you just know that you're going to be adding a freshman 15.
Well, that's it. I don't need a world where snickerdoodles are at my disposal at every moment. So interesting choices. Gregory, of course, just bangs out the smartest, simplest challenge here. He uses tapioca flour, which is really starchy. It's perfect for like fluffy, cakey things. And he does, what does he do? He does what everybody in the world loves. Who doesn't love pancakes with maple syrup and blueberry compote? You can have your other stuff. You can have your cornmeal cassava porridge, which looked lovely from Eric. You can have your garbanzo flour falafel, looked very nice from Karen. But Gregory knows what the world wants, and what the world loves is pancakes, blueberries, and maple syrup. And he wins the quickfire with this.
You know, it's amazing. He's gotten this far by being gluten-free for the last 10 years.
I was shocked to hear that.
Think about that. You're a chef that is just killing the competition, right? In the season 12 when he was on the show. Gets on All Stars, does extremely well. He's one of the best Top Chef contestants of all time. Then you find out that he just hasn't been eating like a giant category on the food chart. Like that's amazing. That's amazing news from Kevin. I mean, Gregory wins this episode, wins the quick fire here. But I thought that Melissa might have won with her duck fat almond financier. I thought that Gregory obviously really thought this challenge through because and everything just seemed like duh. I should have done that, but he nails it.
Confession: I have always known what a financier is. I didn't know it was called a financier. I just knew it was one of those little Frenchy kind of nice crust, like a muffin texture in the middle with like the nice crust on the outside. It never knew it had a name. It obviously didn't have a name, but that is it. Nini also places in the quick fire with her Vietnamese rice crepe that looked delicious, doing her thing. I'm very happy about Stephanie's performance in this episode. I think she's a confidence chef. And she did a nice blue corn gnocchi. I love blue corn. I learned about blue corn for the first time when I was living in Santa Fe, where there's this wonderful place in Santa Fe, New Mexico called Tecolate, where I ate like three mornings a week. It is like an old school New Mexican diner. And they had blue corn pancakes with piñon that I was absolutely crazy about and loved going there. They also had the best huevos rancheros with green chili. We need a Top Chef Santa Fe. That would be a really good. That would be a really good, you could do kind of fold in some Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul celebrity stuff in there. Like it would be a particularly good season of Top Chef.
Can I say something about Steph real quick?
Yeah, please.
Her dishes are starting to look the same. This one looked almost exactly the same as her chili from the last episode. Just kind of the same motifs in there. I don't know. I feel like Steph, I'm sad that Nini's gone, but at least we still have Steph, who is adorable on this show, and she's got some great one-liners, and she still brought it on this episode with her little like buddy cop show with Gregory. Love that. But the Steph gnocchi, I couldn't really see the gnocchi on the dish, and I thought, man, this looks exactly like that veggie chili that she made from the last episode. So just a note on Steph.
Yeah, all right. So I mean, it's sort of reaffirms what we talked about last week, is that while we like her food, she's clearly a good dish, kind of a plate chef, that there is a lack of imagination at times.
I'm not surprised, Kevin, that she wins in the – or she does very well in the elimination challenge when she only has to make a dish for, six people or whatever right. It is.
I want to talk about Voltaggio for a second because a theme is emerging with Voltaggio. So again, as he's done several times this season, he makes a gorgeous dish in the quickfire. Mm-hmm. And – he ends up on the bottom because it does not adhere to the parameters of the challenge. He does not feature or he does not highlight the featured item. They're supposed to really work with this flower. And what he does is a gorgeous piece of roasted sole with a beautiful pea puree, and just uses a bit of hazelnut flour to create an olive crumble. So it is the least flowery of the flour dishes. The chefs like the dish in and of itself, but ding him for not adhering to the spirit of the challenge. And again, yes. And we'll talk about it in the elimination, but you could argue that, again, they do as refined and nice a dish as anybody on the table, but they didn't really nail the spirit of the challenge. So Voltaggio is kind of cooking Voltaggio food, and he ain't going to get sent home for it, at least not anytime soon. But there's going to be a day, Tom, where Voltaggio cooks a beautiful plate that nevertheless has to go home because the competition is so stiff that he is going to get dinged, because not because he fouls up a dish, but because he just colors too far outside the lines in his insistence on coloring very far inside the Voltaggio lines.
Right, which is dumbfounding, because Brian Voltaggio has been on Top Chef twice, and he's actually been like a guest judge on the show. So you feel like he would understand the parameters of each of the competitions, right? Like you would think that he would think this through and be like, okay, I know I can make this dish, and I know I can add this element that is the spirit of the dish, but is it going to win because this is the main event of the dish? Like, that's the sort of thinking you need to have on Top Chef. And it doesn't seem like he's connecting all those dots, even though he might be the most experienced member of the staff.
Right. He looks like a chef who's treating the challenge as an unfortunate inconvenience, right? Mm. Oh, damn. Okay. So, all right. You want some wheat? Here's a little crumble. Now I checked the box, right? Oh, you want these two flavor, you want sweet bitter? Oh, fine. We'll just do up a bitter greens and pork loin, and yeah, there'll be a little sweet around the crust of this this negligible crust of the loin. And I just feel like he's one of my favorite chefs on the show. I just feel like it's going to bite him in the ass. There are too many. We're starting to see what the most notable consequence of this week was. This is the first week where someone went home for a dish that would be top three in any other season, in any other challenge, right? Yes. Like I want to talk more about this, the weird sort of heartbreaking conundrum that this challenge, elimination challenge, was. But
Brian, remember last episode, maybe we talked about how Brian Voltaggio is kind of this like sleeping tiger, almost. Like he's really underperforming right now, but you probably wouldn't bet against him in the next like six episodes. Like, It's continued to be the LeBron parallel for Brian Voltaggio, where I remember a few years ago, they were awful on defense, and you kept saying to yourself, there's no team that can come back after being the 29th best defense after the All-Star break and still get to the finals. And yet LeBron did. And I kind of feel like Voltaggio is the LeBron of this competition, where you know that he's just kind of sleepwalking his way through here, and he's kind of just teasing everybody with how good he is. He's producing great dishes, but not in the spirit of the competition. And I just think he's going to connect everything together later. At least I hope he's on my team.
Right. And again, I wouldn't be worried about him, but he's going to at some point have to realize that he can go home for a really good dish at this point in this season, merely because he doesn't adhere to the spirit of the challenge. And I think that's like, if you asked me, hey, if you told me right now, Voltaggio is going to go home sometime in the next 3 or 4 weeks before we get to the final four, why? I would say like he puts together a beautiful technical dish that doesn't adhere to the parameters of a challenge, or doesn't sufficiently adhere to the parameters of a challenge. And that's the thing. Of course, we get our comic relief in Malarkey. He actually apparently makes a very lovely ice cream, but was going to do some sort of, I don't know, raspberry-filled donut with a coconut crackling over the ice cream, which I think he managed to do, but everybody was amused, and it was our malarkey moment.
No, Padma wasn't amused.
Oh, she was. You could see she was amused.
When he was doing his whole
I was going to have the raspberry jelly, but she was totally amused.
I wish we had a Zoom video right now, because I would be doing my Brian Malarkey impression. My hands are out. Okay, my eyes are really big, and I'm holding my hands out. It's like I'm playing patty cake with you. Okay, all right. Before you come over here. Now stop and close your eyes, okay? Imagine this luscious donut filled with this raspberry jam served next to a coconut ice cream, next level, over the top. And then Padma looks down and it's a scoop of fucking ice cream. This is malarkey in a nutshell. Is he's going to talk up this beautiful game, next level, over the top. You've never tasted anything like this. And you look down and it's a fart. That's what it is. It is. And poor Chris has to sit here and be like, really? Really? There's nine chefs. I only get to do this once. And you're giving me an ice cream scoop? And look, Kevin, I know it's all part of the joke. Everyone's in on it. And you got to see the pan through the kitchen at Eric and Steph. And they're all laughing, kind of like, oh, here we go again with Brian Malarkey. But Kevin, this is a clear misstep when he screwed up the ice cream the first time and he goes to ice cream again. So so you're saying he's a good character, but in terms of performance, he is just at this point. Obviously foreshadowing here. I don't understand how he's still in the competition.
Well, I mean, he's a good heel. And
are you suggesting that the chefs are keeping him in the competition for good entertainment purposes?
No. I'm suggesting that actually his food generally tastes pretty good in elimination challenges, good enough that there's always going to be somebody below him. And I don't suspect he'll be around for much longer. But I'm starting to appreciate his presence more. Okay. as a friendly annoyance. So the double, this is going to be a double elimination challenge. And I know, Tom, you feel the same way I do, which is I always find it revealing in a situation where chefs have to partner up and they get to choose their partners. You and I both have a fondness for the Top Chef production crew. I do wish, however, that they'd keep the wide shot running through the moment when Padma says, okay, find a partner. Because it does tell you so much about the personal dynamics in the inter-chef dynamics in the show when you get to see which chefs want to run over to which chefs.
You're so right about that. Now that I think about it, I so want that. It's just dead air, like no music. Just show me what the raw video of them trying to sort out who goes with who. And Kevin, when you're thinking about this, is your first inclination, if you're Chef Kevin on the show, not Kevin Gillespie, Kevin Artemis, are you going for the person you get along with the most? Are you going with someone who you know is the best chef? Or are you going with someone first that you – are you checking for their knives first and seeing who am I going to match up better? So I'm wondering, what is your strategy in this situation? Are you going for your best person, your best collaborator, the best chef? Or are you checking the knives first?
So I'm thinking I'm a professional chef, so I'm not going to worry that, ooh, I have sour, I have to be with sweet, or I need to be with umami. Like I'm assuming that I can wed two tastes together. Mm-hmm. I'm going with Gregory, and here's why I'm going with Gregory. There, he is orderly, he is calm, he is brilliant, and the stuff he knows how – there's no chaos ever associated with this dish. There's just enough whimsy. You don't want too much whimsy when you're working with somebody else because whimsical people are great and you love their art, but I don't necessarily want to create art with them. So to me, it's such an easy call. Like I am running. Run, do not walk over to Gregory.
And Steph makes the move there. That was, oh, yeah. And it seemed like – all right, so the first people that link up, you got Nini and Karen. Dun, dun, dun. Best friends. They link up immediately. They know that they really like each other. They know they work well with each other. Great off the court, on the court. They link up. Then I believe Steph and Gregory kind of match up. But Eric and Brian Voltaggio were kind of a little bit late. It was like, what do you got? You got sour or I got bitter? All right, well, I guess let's do it. And they just kind of like tap knives and they're in. But I was surprised by the fact that Eric and Voltaggio, it wasn't like a boom right off the bat, or Gregory and Steph. I know that Gregory and Steph worked together before. And I think it's kind of – I think it's endearing to me that Gregory was cool with that because Stephanie's really struggled on the show. And yet this is a guy who is – it might be the second favorite at this point. And he still links up with Stephanie. I kind of love that.
Yeah. I mean there was only a group of three and they were two of the three. They won. I would imagine that Stephanie's easy to work with. He can provide any imagination that she lacks. I just think – and I think they're probably – they're both pretty precise chefs. I mean, I just think it makes sense to me. You know, Kevin's going to be great, but again, I mean, he's fantastic. A little bit of a cowboy. Yeah, you don't know. You know, again, Voltaggio and Eric, I couldn't see if they kind of sought each other out. You suggested that you feel like they kind of were just, it was the music, the music stopped. You had to find a chair and they were kind of with each other. I do think it's, you know, and obviously it seemed as if all eight chefs as politely as possible wanted nothing to do with either Leanne or Malarkey. Am I correct there?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Let's power rank them real quick. Okay. You got Karen and Nini, Leanne and Brian Malarkey, Gregory and Steph, Eric and Voltaggio, Melissa and Kevin. I go Melissa and Kevin number Easy. One. I go Eric and Voltaggio two. I go Karen and Nini three, Gregory and Steph four, and Leanne and Brian Malarkey five.
Yeah, I'm going to flip Voltaggio and Eric, and I don't say this with hindsight. I feel like, and here's why, I feel like in a two-person team, it's not the average of the two. It's the ranking of the top. In other words, you don't average Gregory and Stephanie if you want an approximation of their talent as a team. Mm. You weight the first person maybe 0.75 and the other person 0.25.
So you're talking ceiling rather than absolute average.
No, because look, a really great chef can rescue a mediocre one, right? And I feel like the team is generally the result of the stronger chef. In terms of elasticity of outcome, right? Like Gregory's not going to the extent you want to say, play down to Stephanie's level. That's insulting. I don't want to suggest that. But I think, you know, the team is going to take on Gregory's potential more than it's going to be hampered by whatever limitations that Stephanie has, in my opinion.
No, I hear that. I hear that.
So I would put Gregory second, yeah.
Okay, so you're going Melissa and Kevin number one, Gregory and Steph number two. Karen and Nini?
I'll probably have Voltaggio and Eric probably. I mean, I still really like Karen as a chef, and and we'll talk more about the crazy Last Chance Kitchen scenarios a little later. In fact, I got to tell you, I feel like Last Chance Kitchen was every bit as notable this week as any of the other two chapters in the episode or in the week. And that's kind of how I would do it. But lo and behold, it's a really – can you recall this early in a season, Tom, with 10 chefs left, there not being one dish that even remotely is even anywhere near clunker status?
Well, I would say there's only five dishes, right?
Right.
So there's only five of the five. There's only one that can go wrong, and they nail all five. So I'm not that surprised. I mean,
yeah, that's a good point.
You know, because it's not like they're creating 10 dishes. You know, this is five dishes that each of these teams, we know that they're really, really, really good at this competition. It's just whether they have the good teamwork, whether they have the chemistry, whether they have the restraint. Because when you have to edit a dish of your own, that's one thing. When you have to edit a dish of someone else's, that takes a lot of chemistry and a lot of just deference. And I think that's why this episode was so – I mean, maybe everyone had struggled with shopping at Whole Foods, but they seemed to zero in on Leanne and Brian Malarkey as really struggling to edit just what they were getting from the store. And it just seemed like, man, this is going to be an absolute roadkill. Leanne and Brian Malarkey are going home. This is going to be quick, and they're going to be a quick out. But no –
I wanted to ask you a question, Tom, because I know you're somebody who likes to watch the Whole Foods supermarket run chaos. And do you think it was a dick move for Leanne to take all the endive?
It would be a dick move if she wasn't in the bottom of this competition. But I feel like if you're Leanne, you need to get an edge wherever you can find it. So screw everyone else. I'm going to go get the endive.
Right. And by the way, to persist with another theme that you've talked about this season, Eric got boxed out. Eric, like, what's going on in the paint there, my friend?
He's getting boxed out all the way into the front row. Man, it's crazy. Eric continues. And Voltaggio got hit with the – he tried to go get the duck, and they had no duck, and so he had to go with the pork. But Eric continues – we're going to have to bring him onto the show later and talk about what he's working on during this pandemic. You know, he's getting 1,000 shots up at the gym. No, he is just doing the killer rebounding drill and just trying to box out everybody. That's what you need to be working on, Eric.
So going back to Leanne and Malarkey, and it was obviously an enormous upset, right? They end up finishing second in out of five. It is pretty much declared. But I think there's a reason why. Because the pairing was so potentially disastrous, and because both Malarkey and Leanne were acutely aware of it, I feel like they approached the day like with the precision of a bomb squad trying to defuse a bomb, because they're so aware of how combustible the situation is. I think they were so conscious of, and they said it at least three or four times, we need to edit, we need to edit. And again, I think it's a question of people being aware of their weaknesses and saying, let's mitigate those weaknesses the best we can. And I think they're being self-conscious. They actually did really beautifully. They had umami and bitter, Tom. They go out, they get the endive. I mean, I'm imagining the orange, charred orange puree. You know, orange zest is pretty friggin' bitter. They have this cheese crisp, but which can play bitter. And then they get the umami. If you told me, like, what's umami, like miso anchovy hollandaise is about as umami as a culinary substance can get. They nailed it. They nailed it, Tom. And beef umami, right?
I thought it was going to crash even at the Whole Foods. I thought it was they were going to miss something. They were going to buy the wrong thing. They were going to forget an ingredient. Of course, Leanne just comes in with the metaphors about Brian Malarkey, saying he's like a cat with a laser pointer. He's like shopping with him is like shopping with monkeys on crack. Leanne is very clear that this was a really big struggle to get to the finish line at Whole Foods and get this dish done. But like you said, now that you frame it that way, it makes sense, because I think they both have an understanding, Kevin, that they are the most likely out in this episode, right? They're looking around and they're seeing these tandems, and they're saying, if we don't get our shit together here, Brian and Leanne, we're going home. So we got to bring it. And they did.
We saw something pretty rare in the elimination challenge this week, and that is an uncharacteristic Gregory error. I am fond of saying that Gregory plays an error-free ball. Like, I mean, this guy never makes a mistake. It's something I've probably said on this broadcast a zillion times. He made a mistake. And the mistake was, he is a guy who does love a little heat. In fact, one of his great strengths as a chef, as I always say, that there's always a spicy, always a sweet, and always a sour element to all of his dishes. That he's able just to take those five tastes, essentially, and marry them with perfect balance. Unfortunately, he brought in spicy in a contest that didn't call for it. And I kind of want to second something that Gail Simmons says. I feel like the last 15 years in food has been about spiciness, right? You've got the contest you talk about, Tom, this show where people just go on and the entire
– Hot Ones. Yep.
Right, Hot Ones. The entire point of the show is to demonstrate that you can take the hot food. Kind of the Sichuan movement, Chengdu taste out here. And I have to say, and part of it is that in my older age, like, I've just, my colon has started to reject spicy food.
Yes, Kevin, we've talked about it on the show.
But my point is I do want to say something. I do think sometimes, a good friend of mine who's a great chef here in Los Angeles kind of confided in me that, like, because one of the things I commented, I was like, you know, I never have to deal with the heat. Like, there's always great flavor in your food, but never heat. He's like, spiciness is so overrated. He's like, you know what spiciness is? It's just numbing your tongue. It's just something that just completely obliterates every other subtlety and taste in a dish. And he's just like, and I'm just so happy to say, like, you know what? I didn't want it. I didn't need it, said Gail Simmons. Put the chilies away sometimes. I sometimes wish chilies were a little farther from the kitchen than they are. I think spiciness has gotten, I think it gets disproportionate play in the culinary arts right now. Just a feeling.
I don't know. I kind of feel like Gregory's doing well with that so far.
Yeah. But
Gregory's, he's doing well. And I think jalapeno in terms of spice, like, I'm not a huge fan of the flavor of jalapeno. So, like, I get what she's going for here, and it probably was, it was superfluous. It really was. The jalapeno added to this dish. I wasn't sure if that was Stephanie or Gregory. I was going to ask you about that, but probably, in retrospect, I think it like was Gregory. It makes sense. It was Gregory.
What was really, by the way, this was a great dish. We're bearing the lead. One of the things that I was really impressed with is when they said they were doing miso mirin sake sea bass. So miso mirin sake is sort of the combination that you get on that Nobu, like miso black cod is a dish we all love, right? And and I started making it at home. And that mirin is sweet. Miso is sort of sweet. Sake is kind of sweet-ish. So what I was really impressed with them is they had sour salty. And I was like, uh-oh, the sweet's going to come through. The sweet's going to come through. The celeriac will kind of temper it. And you've got pickled apples and you've got like the bacon and yuzu to kind of do the salty sour. But I was afraid that the miso mirin sake combo would just be like, this is going to be a sweet dish. And it wasn't. So, I put the heat was their air and which kept them from being in the top two. But they still nailed the dish in a really graceful way. Because, again, that could have been a dish that tasted sweet.
Yeah, I mean, listen to that dish. Sea bass glazed and miso mirin and sake with sauteed celeriac, pickled apples, bacon, and yuzu. Lots going on there. But it sounds delicious. And without the hint of jalapeno or the overpowering jalapeno in the broth, that might have won the night.
Another middle dish, and then we'll get to like the bottom. The other kind of the fourth out of fifth place finisher, and they were on the chopping block. Brian and Eric. I mean, Tom, this is a surprise, right? I mean, you had them power ranked number two. These guys know what they're doing. They had a plan. I love their plan, right? Valtaggio is this structuralist. So he's going to, as Eric said, build the framework for the dish, and then you let, you know, Eric get in there. He defers to Eric on flavor notes, on creative direction. They're going to do a nutty stew lacquered pork loin with bitter greens, and it all sounds like it's brilliant.
Just a little bit too much pork. Surface area was a problem on this one, and when it came out, I don't know about you, Kevin. I like a nice, fatty, salty crust on my pork. And when you have it sliced thin like that, that's a lot of surface area for a little bit of the sweet on the top. And I think immediately when I saw the dish, that's what I thought about, is that's something my mama makes. Like that, my mom is not a great cook. And I just think that when you're on Top Chef, you got to make that ratio right. And Tom pointed that out. And I thought that was, you know, if we're nitpicking, I thought that was a pretty simple thing that I thought if they tasted the dish or if they ate the dish, they would have tried to edited that a little bit down and cut that pork slice in half so that you get an equal ratio of the fat and topping crust with the meat itself. And it might have been dried out. I don't remember if that was one of the critiques, but this seemed like a really good dish. Just needed just a slight cut there on the pork.
Yeah. And Timmy Hollingsworth, who is the chef at Odeum, where the competition took place, and quick diversion. So Odeum is where you always eat before you go to Disney Hall for a concert, or you go to the Mark Taper Forum for a play, or the Amundsen Theater. And so I eat there frequently because it is just like, it's the best option. You can walk right across. Also, they know you're going to a show at 8, so they get you out at 7:30 kind of thing. And he had the idea for these guys, which was, look, how about just a little kind of roasted apple compote or something with onion that would bring out the sweetness. That is a great space, by the way. The other thing is, one of the cooler mornings of my life, Tom, was I got a private tour of Disney Hall before it opened by architect Frank Gehry.
Wow.
Seriously, one of the coolest 3 hours of my life. My friend was in town from New York. She was doing a big piece on the construction and the completion of this beautiful building, and invited me. She's like, I'm getting a tour with Frank Gehry. You want to come along? And I was like, yeah, that'd be great. and so it's just, it is such a gorgeous building. I love, and we'll talk about the cabbage in a second, but I love that it was inspiration to the chefs visually. Gustavo Dudamel, dude, he is like, let me just say this. He's like LeBron in high school, man. Like Dudamel took over the LA Phil before he turned 30, man. Like,
wow.
This guy is like, when you talk to classical music dorks, and I've got a few in my life, like this guy was LeBron. Like this guy, I mean, running the LA Phil before you're 30 is being the musical director of the LA Phil is like a really big deal. Like people
and
work
he's
there.
He's charming. He's great. Like this episode, I was like, more of this guy.
Yeah. I mean, he took over from Esa Pekka-Salonen, and I actually saw the two of them together, I think like about 6-7 years ago at a concert there. And, but I was just like, I didn't think they played that up enough. Like this dude is like one of the great prodigies of the 21st century musically. So anyway, that was just another thing, but I love that they were in the shadow of Disney Hall. I like Odeum a lot. We always go there before a play. And I thought his suggestion, Hansworth's suggestion, would have been was smart, right? Like all they needed was like a little roasted apple, little onion with, you know, balsamic or whatever it was. Like they could have done just a little more sweetness, and they could have even gotten away with the crust being limited, but they just didn't have enough sweet on the dish.
Yeah.
It almost sent them home, Tom. Almost sent them home.
Kevin, when they lined them up with Voltaggio and Eric alongside Nini and Karen, did you notice that that was two on my team and then two on your team?
All right, Tom, we'll talk about my team. It is a train wreck. You know what? In the words of Michael Ray Richardson on the 1981-82 New York Knicks, Tom, the ship be sinking. The ship be sinking. It's I bad, am so Kevin. Fucked. Like this. I don't even. Am I even mathematically eligible to win this thing, Tom?
You got Kevin Gillespie. I'll just put it that way.
I have Kevin Gillespie. I mean, that's basically
that's it.
It.
It's the only ray of sun that I'm giving you on this.
I am so fucked.
I thought you were set when they came out first, when they walked up, when they got the elimination challenge prompt that they get linked up and it seemed like they got their dish together. I thought that they were in.
I mean, look, these women cooked a fantastic dish. Let's talk about it for a second. They get sour umami. They're doing a poached cod in a tomato broth with pickled cucumbers. Everything suggests that they've got the components to bring out the sour and the umami. And instead, it ate sweet and sour, and they didn't hit the umami. So let's talk about umami, Tom, because I think it's like, you know it when you taste it. You can't really describe it. I'm going to make a confession, and this is going to terrorize everybody who comes to my house for dinner. I cook with MSG. God damn it. I cook with MSG. I don't care who knows it. The anti-MSG movement of my early childhood in the late 70s and 80s was frankly racist. This bullshit about you go to a Chinese restaurant, you get a headache is baloney. This is a sodium compound that people have been cooking with for centuries. There is a reason Chinese food is really good, and it has been great for centuries. So umami is the savoriness. If you ever dip your finger in a little MSG and kind of just put the crystals on your tongue, that's it. Like, you know what's umami-ish? Voltaggio, I would guarantee you. Remember his squid bolognese from last week?
Yeah.
That is a, I'm going to guess, is umami-ish. Umami-ish, you know what the ultimate umami is? You know when you go to a really, you go to Naoi or one of your favorite Japanese places, and they have that really good roasted, crispy seaweed wrap around the hand roll?
That's umami.
That's umami. And you know what else is umami? Tomatoes, when you cook the water out of them and you really concentrate them like a tomato sauce that's been simmering for hours and all the water's gone. And it's just that is umami. And the problem with what Karen and Nini did was there was still too much water left in their tomatoes. So the tomatoes, we all love fresh tomatoes. And you know, I think Hollingsworth kind of said that the cruel irony for these women, which was that the fact that the fresh tomatoes were so nice in their fresh tomatoness sunk them. Yep. Because if only the tomatoes had been a shittier element, then nobody would have noticed that they were stealing away. They were eating sweet because they weren't supposed to be sweet. And fresh tomatoes are sweet. Cooked tomatoes are not.
One of my favorite things on this planet is a roasted tomato. You slice up the tomato, you throw it in the oven. My sister-in-law makes an amazing roasted tomato dish. Mm. They get it fresh from their garden. And immediately when I walk into their home in Waynesville, North Carolina, I just say, give me some roasted tomatoes. It is so good. If you want an umami bomb, you're going to go for that. Or this is the list of strong umami flavor foods. You got broths, gravies, soups, shellfish, fish sauce, tomatoes, mushrooms, meat extract, yeast extract, cheeses, and soy sauce. Like when you get that roasted tomato just to melt down a little bit, I could eat a fucking car full of that stuff. It is so good. And I love – tomato might be my favorite fruit.
Oh, it's the best.
It's the best.
The best.
I sit there and I'm like, what do I want? Oh, tomato soup. What do I want? Some salsa. What do I want? Some roasted tomato. Like, I just go for tomato, anything. And then this particular dish with Nini and Karen, it's a minor error, but it's a fatal one. When you're going against all these others, it's so sad because you know, this is Top Chef. Like, if they're being graded purely on the deliciousness of their dish, they might win this damn thing. But because they didn't come through with that strong umami flavor, because they didn't cook that tomato, I get it. I get why they're going home here, but it's heartbreaking.
And Karen, you know, kind of suggested unintentionally what they did wrong. Like, she's like, okay, we're going to, I think she understood that the tomatoes as constituted were not going to get either sour umami. So what I'll do, I'll compress them with a little fish sauce. Good idea. But ultimately, like, not, you needed to get, to me, you needed to concentrate it. Like, you needed to get that water out to get, I mean, the other team that had umami was Leanna Mullarkey. And when you look at that plate, like, there's a reason that the orange puree was charred, right? Like, there was a reason they had the cheese crisp and the miso anchovy hollandaise, like the beef. There wasn't a component there that wasn't just kind of dense in its flavor. And that was sort of the contrast. And when you look at Karen and Nini, they just, I mean, and it's so sad. I mean, Tom, I still feel like we have more to see from Nini. She is my Anthony Randolph. Let me tell you, Tom, like she is, I know that one of the best chefs that's ever top chefs is Nini. And there's nothing you can do to dissuade me from this. I think her record demonstrates it. It's just, she has gotten a couple bad luck. I mean, look, she went home for front of the house last time. She's going home from being on a team that cooked a dish that would be in the top three in any other competition.
You're absolutely right.
I'm heartbroken about it. Finally, though, let's do the good news real quick. Because Kevin and Melissa, ballsy are Kevin and Melissa? You know what we're going to do for the win? Roasted cabbage.
Yes.
Like, that's how badass we are. We're going to take roasted cabbage because, you know, because the lovely kind of these metal drapes or whatever you want to call them and this gorgeous arc that is the interior of Disney Hall reminded us of cabbage leaves. So goddamn it, we're gonna make roasted cabbage with a caramel fish sauce and pork crumble and a little apple. It's sweet and salty, and we're gonna take that all the way home.
This is a beautiful mind type shit. The fact that they went into this concert hall and said, not only am I gonna just take inspiration from the architecture of this building, I'm gonna infuse these two categories of flavor here, and I'm just gonna not use a protein. Like, it's not even, hey, let's do a steak, and then as a side, let's do some roasted cabbage. They made the cabbage the main event. What a ballsy move here by Melissa and Kevin, and so much confidence. Like, at no point in this episode did you feel like, you know what? I know they did cabbage, but is this a bad idea? No, they executed this one to perfection, and Melissa and Kevin win this episode, and it just blew the chefs away, the judges away.
Tom, at this point, I would trust that team of two to some bubble wrap and marshmallow fluff and have them just make a goddamn winning dish. So they get the 10, Tom. Leanna Mullarkey come in second. Nini.
They get in the top three for the voting.
And
for
I appreciate your scoring. I appreciated that. And then obviously Nini and Karen, in a heartbreaking manner, are sent to Last Chance Kitchen, where they team up again. Not team up, rather. It's the two of them plus Lisa, elimination. Make something
so
sweet
fun
and sour.
That was so fun when Tom is just like, and Last Chance Kitchen starts now. That was so cool. He puts on the coat, the chef coat, and we're ready to go with the rest of the team. I thought maybe at first that we were going to have like some sort of combination of the past contestants as sous chefs because they brought them out. I thought for a moment it was going to be one of those like, hey, pick a sous chef and then you guys are going to produce a dish together. But no, it's a one versus one, and there we go.
You know, Tom, this is a fascinating three-way competition. Sweet and sour shrimp for Karen. Boy, you know what? It's interesting. I think the heartbreak just drove Karen to some of her best cooking in these two episodes of Last Chance Kitchen, right? I mean, she does this lovely, clean, sweet and sour shrimp with, I want to do this. I'm going to grill some pineapple and then pickle it. What a great accompaniment to like just some really nice acidic seafood. I mean, that's beautiful because she dressed the shrimp with a fish sauce dressing. And it was slightly more refined than the Nini Lisa dishes. Nini did a steak that she had to deep fry. Oh my God, Nini was a mess in Last Chance Kitchen. Kind of salvaged it both times, but she burned three steaks to the point where she finally had to just throw some steak in a deep fryer at the last minute. But it was enough to move on. And Lisa had a nice looking scallop dish with a tamarind lacquer and kefir lime and these nice little potato chips. But ultimately, Karen and Nene move on, Tom.
Yep.
To the final finale to see who is going to go back in the competition. And Karen just makes a beautiful meal. The whole conceit is a family meal, which in restaurants is like the chef and the crew and everybody, the meal that they all make collectively for the employees.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to say just a second here, Lisa, it just wasn't meant to be. Minus 11 for me, for my – that Kevin, it, without Lisa, this would be a blowout. But right now,
it's still a blowout.
Lisa, I pick you up for 6 points off my total, and you end up giving me a minus 5 the rest of the way. So a minus 11 combined. It was not a great pickup by me. But you know what? When you hit with Gregory and Eric and Voltaggio and Melissa and Leanne – that's okay. You can absorb Elisa Fernandez. But anyway, yes, Karen versus Nene, the family meal. Look, Nene comes in with the chicken curry and just leaves. I don't know what happened here. Did she forget about it? Or like, did it? Did someone? Did Eric Ajapong nudge it up a level like he did against Jen? No, I'm just kidding, Eric. You would never have done that. But how did that happen? How did Nene, who's cooked this dish a billion times, you know what I think it was, Kevin? Fatigue, exhaustion.
I was exactly what I was going to say, Tom. And Karen talked about it. She said we've just done this entire meal for this entire orchestra, and 20 minutes later, I'm cooking another. Two new dishes. I just think they were beaten down, and Nene salvages her chicken curry with delicata squash. I love a mango salad with that like kind of fish sauce, a little bit of chili, not too much. I love that dish, and she just torched the bottom of that pan. But she recovered, but nothing. She couldn't stand to Karen's whole branzino that she just drops in the fryer for just a second. Lovely bright salsa verde. She did this pasta side, roasted fennel. I think the defining quality of the family meal is it's a series of dishes that almost unintentionally come together because you kind of just grab whatever's here. Like, give me some dry pasta. I'll make a sauce for that. Oh, what do we got? A fish. All right, let's throw that in the fryer. We'll need something a little green. Okay, let's, you know, and she just did it beautifully. And I'm very excited that Karen is going back into the competition, Tom, because I feel like we still haven't seen some of her best. I think she's got some serious game. There's a reason I picked her high. And I got to tell you, I'm very happy, and I'm happy for her. I think she was legitimately devastated that she was off that show from that dish that they didn't even screw up.
Here's the thing about Karen. Is she perpetually on the verge of crying? She always in her confessionals, it always seems like she's crying or like on the verge of crying, or on the show, it seems like she's just overwhelmed. And every time she puts a dish together, I'm like, that's brilliant. She is so smart. You can tell that she's a James Beard Award winner whenever she's putting together a dish. But I feel like in the confessionals, she's always just welling up and ready to burst. And then she does burst. Like at the end of this episode, when she figures out that she's going back in the competition, she just falls apart crying. And I understand. She just had to do the elimination challenge. Then two dishes on top of each other going against her best friend in the competition. This must have been an absolute emotional roller coaster for her.
Well, I think you're missing one important biographical fact here. She was a musical theater major, Tom. Oh, yeah. So when you want to understand the temperament, the emoting, the spirit, you're dealing with a musical theater major.
Amen.
And I think that is what – so when she see – if she's going to burst into song or burst into tears or burst into hysteria, that is what you're recognizing, Tom.
Yes.
It is the heart of a musical theater major. Do you have any closing thoughts for us?
You know, I want to say it again. Magical Elves, Top Chef, Bravo. Excellent episode here, just editing. I thought for sure those two, Malarkey and Liam Wong, were going home. And it got to the point where I was like, no, they can't go home because everything is going so poorly for them. And knowing who they are, there's no way that they're going to go home because it's just – the Magical Elves never do that. They never show their hands so much that – you're going to have to keep guessing. And at this point, just the preview, the editing during the show, it was fantastic. I thought it was really great and a real curveball. When I was looking at this, I was saying, if it wasn't Malarkey and Leanne Wong, who's it going to be? And man, Nene and Karen, that you, we're at this point in the competition where in editing for stories, when you hand in an article and it's a couple thousand words too long, you know what they say? Tom, we got to kill some babies here. I'm sorry. That's what happened on this episode. I felt like Nene should not be going home at this point in the competition, especially for a dish that was awesome. But hey, we got to kill some babies and it's going to be really sad. But here we are. And well done by the editing team.
Tom, as Padma said, I think this is true for the rest of the way here. Good food is just the baseline. For Tom Haberstroh, I'm Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.